cliffcentral.com.
Fly mal, motherfuckers.
Zielandi Fisser. Well, die antwoord. I love those guys. That's called Babies on Fire. I haven't heard that song in ages. Suddenly thought of it now. And I got this comment, which interestingly comes in. The timing is perfect. Ulrich says, playing die Antwoord, where they say Jesus' name won't save Greg's son from his friend. If you don't know what we're talking about, got a message from Greg. He's got a four-year-old. And Greg says his four-year-old was sitting at 3 a.m. and said to his father when he walked in, his father, Greg, leave us. There was no one else in the room. Now, you might have some advice for Greg. You're welcome to share that advice with us. And here's another comment on the song that we just played. This is from Robin. Robin says, listening to the Antwoord makes me feel like I need an exorcism. Ah, good morning, Kent and Pillay. How are you?
Get out.
Leave us. All right, it's time for the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Every single Thursday, around about this time, we get into some of the issues that people are talking about, some big stories. And Canton is here. Canton Pillay, as usual, our return champion. And this morning, we're also joined by Yan-Yan Hubert, who is an author, journalist, and political commentator. We've met Yan-Yan before. He's covered Parliament since 2011 for various publications. He was previously political editor of Die Burger, Bild and Report, as well as deputy political editor of the Sunday Times. He lives in Cape Town, and he's on the line. Good morning, Yan-Yan. How are you?
Good morning, Gareth. Very well yourself.
Good, man. Nice to speak to you. And, Canthan, welcome, as always. Where do we begin? Let's start with SAA, gentlemen. Is that okay?
Well, I'm not flying today, so that's fine.
Yeah, all right. Well, this is a disaster of unbelievable proportions, because they say now there's a secondary strike on the way, and that this may also affect the other airlines. But let's just go back to basics on this. This is about a group of workers and their unions who are not dealing well with the realities of the modern world, an economy of supply and demand, and the fact that South African taxpayers and the government even, according to statements by Pravin Gordhan yesterday, have had it up to here with bailing them out time and time again, essentially throwing really good money after bad. Is there a solution on the cards? Do you believe that this thing can be resolved? I know Canton has said innumerable times before, let it go. Let SAA go. And let's see what happens. Probably will be better for everybody and will cost us a lot less in the long run. So what do you think, Yan-Yan, before we get to Canton's point of view? And what are your latest discoveries around this story? Are there any things that I'm missing in my appraisal of what's going on? Say that again.
Is concerned, but I think you need to keep your eyes open for the immediate future. We'll get to that. I think, firstly, that this issue is very basic. The unions refuse to understand or acknowledge that the money, there's no more money in the kitty. That's it. And, you know, at the moment what they are doing is they are demanding more money, and it is roughly equivalent to having your father die but be held on life support and then standing next to the non-responsive body and demanding pocket money. It's not going to happen. So I think today might be a very important day, if my information is correct. Two things will happen, one of which I can talk about.
Yeah.
That would be that there will be a discussion in the ANC Parliamentary Caucus this morning on what to do about SAA. And that discussion, on my information, this is, of course, behind closed doors, was requested by members of the ANC caucus who are unhappy with the policies espoused by Ministers Mboweni, Gordhan, and the President. They would like the government to agree to a 2 billion rand bailout and to the demands of the strikers for more than 8% increase, whereas government is offering 5.9. And thirdly, those people, we do not know whether they're the majority, but those unhappy people in the ANC caucus also demand that SAA not be privatized in any way. The other matter you will see develop during the day, and that's going to be very dramatic, but unfortunately I cannot speak on it. Just keep your eyes open.
Very exciting. That sounds tantalizing. I'm sorry that you can't tell us more, Yan Yan, but we'll no doubt find out shortly. Canton, what do you think of Yan Yan's comment about what this ANC parliamentary caucus meeting might have to say about SAA's future?
I think the ANC parliamentary caucus doesn't matter.
Really?
Really. Well, Luthuli House is the power behind the ANC. The parliamentary caucus can actually, you know, wring their wrists as much as they want to, but ultimately they don't have any influence whatsoever in terms of what the ministers are currently doing. And by the time the ANC parliamentary caucus are finally able to firstly get themselves into parliament, secondly keep themselves awake long enough to actually conduct a sustained debate, SAA will probably be shut down by that time. And, you know, from my side, I certainly can't wait for that to happen. But but let's leave the wishful thinking aside for now.
Right.
I think what's really...
Can I take you on?
No, hang on a second, Yan. I just want to bring in something else. The thing in terms of Solidaritet, which has now launched an application to have SAA put into business rescue. And I think that's a fairly interesting development. And I think let's talk about that and see where that goes. Yanya, you can have the floor.
Yes, absolutely. That was actually what I was referring to. I wasn't clear that they had gone public on the plans.
No, they have not gone public on the plans. I'm just well informed.
Oh.
Okay, good for you. Let's wait for it to happen, though. But as far as the ANC caucus goes, of course they matter. I mean, we don't have to like them. They are in Parliament. That is why they don't have to get themselves there. They are there this morning. They have caucus meeting. If the caucus should decide that...
We're being facetious. It's what we do on this show. We take the piss out of everyone.
If they were to take a decision not to agree with Mr. Gordhan's position, which is clearly stated, you must remember that Mr. Gordhan's position and that of Mr. Mboweni cannot be implemented without parliamentary approval. And if the ANC caucus this morning decides, and I'm not saying they will, but it is one of the plans being mooted, that there is a formal and binding ANC caucus decision to not support this line of policy, because this is what is said. It clashes with the decisions taken at the ANC conference in NASDAQ, which it certainly does, and because there is an opinion that that basically those ministers are going rogue. They do just what they want. They do not consult. If that view holds, which is not impossible and hopefully won't happen, then there is no way to implement any decisions taken by Cabinet or by the ministers themselves, because they require parliamentary approval to implement them. And parliamentary approval would be impossible if there's a binding decision not to support it from the majority party. That's why it matters.
Well, it sounds like there's going to be some drama then. And SAA will
I'm not saying they're going to win. I'm saying it's on the table.
Well, I mean, either way, this is going to be very exciting. All of us can brace ourselves for some serious heated interactions then. And a lot of it, as you say, Yan Yan, will occur behind closed doors. So maybe it won't be played out in front of us in real time. Ultimately, though...
Oh, the newspapers are watching.
I'm sure you are. All right. So let's just talk quickly about your book, your second book, Will South Africa Be Okay? I do love the title, Yan Yan, and I mean, we've spoken about your book before. Yeah, it's terrific. It's been hailed as the book every South African who cares about the country's future and wants to be better informed has to read. Based on what you've researched for your book and the things that you can share with us around the current state of South Africa and the current state of the ANC, since they're inextricably linked. These policies that our government seems to like to, our government likes to, the ANC certainly likes to embody the policies that sometimes don't entirely fit the practicalities of the day. I think that's what you and Canton are both saying here. Is there any way in the future that you can see an ANC that will be able to reform, be realistic, or do you think that it's really just about a spiral into more craziness, where we have unions and socialist ideas from the 1920s being implemented, where we have people thinking that the coffers will always be refilled even though they're empty? What's your overall assumption about the direction of South Africa's economic future?
Well, this is a good day to ask it, is it not?
Yeah.
Because to some degree, this is the day on which some direction will be given one way or the other.
Right.
What the book states, and obviously you know how it is to write a book, I think, you know, you write it at a specific time and then there's a bit of a delay before it's published. So I did not foresee that it would become quite as topical as it has. You know, I'm being complimented from all sides for timing. It didn't come into it. It's sheer luck. But being as it is, much of the book is dedicated to the current position of the ANC, and I fully agree with your assessment, yes, controversial as it will be. The ANC leadership is completely out of touch with the realities of South Africa. Well, not the complete leadership, but many in there, and many of the voters, for the exact reason that you state. They think that the state will provide. Mm-hmm. The state has not the money to provide. So for us to be successful and to be okay, the ANC has to take extremely tough and at the same time extremely clear decisions. They have to start governing and not just spending. And there are steps in the book that they need to follow. One of the most important is project management, which is perhaps not the world's most exciting thing. But if you think about it, the most important thing about successful project management is preventative management, which means that you literally fix something before it breaks. It's the same argument as why you take your car in every 15,000 kilometers, whether there's anything wrong or not. Now, these things, as far as infrastructure goes, are very well recorded. You know, there are rules on how often, for instance, sewage pipes have to be gone through and checked. It's just not done by the ANC governments. And you guys in Joburg have had a controversial change of government since 2016. But look at what happened at the M2. Now, that is preventative management. That is what you want to do. You fix the bridge before it collapses.
Right.
And I think that is one of the main things the ANC needs to do.
Is it likely that that debate will end in anything practical, useful, or responsible? Because this is what I'm really asking. It's not just not what has to happen, but will it happen? Who will win out? Because we've got some pragmatists and we've got some people who are ideological.
Yes, Gareth. That is our problem. And the point of a book is that it must be fixed. There are very specific steps they need to take. And they must stop being ideological. They must stop stealing. They must stop mismanaging, and there are steps to be taken, and that's what the book sets out to do. Whether that will happen, my friend, if we knew exactly what would happen, and I'm not referring to the solidarity issue spoken about earlier, generally we don't know what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
So I cannot tell you whether the ANC will do the right thing, but they will never be able to claim that they didn't know what it was.
I wanted you to be our Nostradamus this morning, but you're letting me down horribly. Okay, let's move on to other things.
Prepare for life's disappointments.
All right, let's go on the stage.
Jan, if I understand correctly, essentially what you are saying is the preventive maintenance thing is the old South African saying, I hit him back first.
Yes, but more so I just fix it first. You know? It's not so hard. Eh?
Sure.
All right, let's talk about the state of the opposition parties. This comes up every
before
week.
We do that, touch on stuff around SAA. The interesting thing for me is that, you know, the unions have now decided that they're going to do a secondary strike against the other airlines because
You know, it's this absurd proposition that by doing so, they'll be able to put pressure on, I suppose, everyone else who's currently flying very happily on the likes of Comair and, and Safair and so forth. And I suspect that they're hoping that by putting pressure on those airlines, that they'll then be able to get the public so hurtful that we'll then turn around and say, okay, just give these guys whatever they want so that they can go back to work and we can carry on flying. What I think is likely to happen here is that they will actually go through a strike ballot for the likes of Kulula and British Airways. But I strongly suspect that those planes will continue to fly because they are not reliant upon the Cabin Crew Association in order for them to actually get their stuff done. And they're not reliant on the same caterers that are being used by South African Airways. And so, in fact, you know, it's no work, no pay that applies, obviously, in terms of strikes. And I think that what's going to happen is that they'll eventually have the strike ballot. 48 hours later, they'll call the strike. And I strongly suspect that if I know the Comair guys, those planes are going to continue flying. So let's see where that takes us.
All right. This whole idea of unions, we've also got to remember that in South Africa, the unions are in a dire state. They're losing support from their own members, let alone from the outside. And they're not really in a position to be bargaining as hard as they once thought they could. Well, am I right, or is that an unfair
assumption?
Well,
the truth of the matter is they never were in a position to really bargain as hard as they could. The point at which they actually gained power was when they sided with Jacob Zuma to go against Thabo Mbeki. Because up until that point, Mbeki used to stay down the unions, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, he'd just send Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi to have these discussions with the public service unions, and she'd just look them in the eye and she'd say no. And that would pretty much be the end of it. And because they needed to be part of the Jacob Zuma entourage, and let's not forget, okay, it was Zwelinzi Mavavi, he of the superb hiring practices, who ended up being responsible for putting Jacob Zuma into that position of power. And look what happened to Zwelinzi Mavavi in terms of his personal grip on union power. And COSATU is a pale shadow of what it used to be. Mm. SAFTU, which is Vavi's new vehicle for personal enrichment, continues to, you know, just basically make noises about things. But you're right. Ultimately, if we look in terms of the unions, their power base has substantially eroded. And I think that my take on this is the unions are going to come off worse in this particular debacle because there is no reason whatsoever why government should now turn around, particularly in light of the fact that we are facing the ratings agencies in a couple of months. If government is going to turn around and kowtow now, then, you know, we are definitely headed for junk status. And I suspect that Mboweni and Gordhan, etc., have actually said, let's sit this one out. We can't afford to do this. It's not like Eskom. Mm. Eskom, we can't afford to shut down Eskom. The country needs Eskom. Can we afford to shut down South African Airways? Yes, we can.
Well, Yan, in your book, you have quite a lot to say about the opposition parties too, because we're not just talking ANC. So what do you think, especially in the light of what's been going on, and you mentioned earlier that when you publish a book, you know, sometimes there's a delay between when you finish putting pen to paper and when they eventually end up printing the book and it becomes available. But since you've written the book, quite a lot's happened in the DA. But you gave us quite a good synopsis of just how much drama has happened there, up to the point where, you know, Musi Maimane resigned and a whole lot of other things. How does this affect the general direction of what you were trying to get across in your book?
It doesn't really change it because it was always clear that there was going to be some point where there was going to be massive upheaval in the air. It was not impossible to say exactly when. Mm. And when it happened, two things occurred which I did not foresee. The first is the return of Helen Zille.
I always considered it a possibility, but an improbability. You know, there are golden rules in politics, and I'm going to quote Dr. Peter Groenewald, the leader of Freedom Front Plus, who says there are two golden rules in politics. The first is nothing stays a secret, and the second is never go back. Huh. Helen Zille broke the second commandment. We'll see how it works out for her. As far as my money goes, he should have gone the day after the election. And I don't mean this in an aggressive, negative, or anything. I don't think he's a bad guy. But when your party regresses, as the DA did at the polling booth, then you resign and give someone else a chance. I think he set back the whole project quite enormously by hanging on and having to be told to go. And as far as the leadership, the new leadership of the DA goes, remember we only have a standing leadership at the DA until April, but I think that what will happen is that there will be direction. What on earth that direction is going to be remains to be seen while the two most powerful people disagree on two of the most powerful issues, namely the race issue and cooperation with the EFF. Whoever wins will decide the direction that goes.
Sorry, who are those two most powerful people? We're talking Helen Zille and?
John Steenhuisen, okay. Who is now the leader of the DA.
Right, okay.
Until April.
Certainly, the interim leader. Okay. Canton, yeah. Any updates on your opinion held last week and your opinion generally about the DA, which you voiced, you know, quite strongly that in fact the DA needed a corrective move, and whether or not this will result in what they hope it will result in is entirely up for debate, but that this was inevitable.
I think that their corrective move actually fell flat on its face because the first words that Steenhuisen uttered when he assumed this position was to start talking about redress. And I kind of yawned and then went off to doing, you know, more interesting stuff.
Than pay
attention to him.
What was wrong with that, and what would the appropriate
What was wrong about it is that it's still taking us down the path of constantly trying to find ways in which to bring race into the debate around how we go about fixing the country. And it's exactly the same boring situation that we have right now around the appointment of the new Eskom CEO. Because instead of the debate being about, given that this guy has been chief executive of Nampak, which has had a steady decline in its share price over the past period under his tenure, is he the right person to be running Eskom? But instead, what we are focusing on is, you know, the transformation agenda has been set back, and surely now we should be able to find competent black people to run Eskom. And it's boring, really. And I think that anyone who was actually hoping that the DA was going to be course correcting at this point is now looking at Steenhuisen, and Steenhuisen is once again going down the path of, you know, apartheid was terrible and we need to seek redress and all of that. But yeah, guess what? You know, the DA and certainly its ancestor, the Progressive Party, followed by the Progressive Federal Party, was not actually responsible for any of that stuff. In fact, there's a track record in that particular party of consistently fighting for one person, one vote, universal franchise, you know, way back in the apartheid days. So really, is this a course correction in terms of the DA? No, I think that Steenhuisen really actually lacks the intellectual capacity to take this thing further. And really, is he going to come up with a message that's going to persuade the people who defected to the Freedom Front Plus to come on board? I don't think so.
Wow, you went all there, Yan-Yan. Yan-Yan? I think we've lost him. He was so horrified by your statement about John Steenhuisen's intellectual capacity that he just dropped the phone in horror. All right, let's talk a little bit about this this Eskom thing, because a lot of people are saying, "Oh, this is terrible news. It's, as you say, setting back transformation." Let's just remember, transformation is largely responsible for the disaster that Eskom is in, right? And this obsession with the color of the person at the top and color of people in between. We've got too few engineers who actually know what they're doing there. We've got a top-heavy structure. We've got thousands of employees we probably don't need. And the state in general, and state-owned enterprises as well, have become like a a place to post a lot of people who require employment because they've, I don't know, served the ANC well or they're well connected. But we're not really sure what they can do, and we're not really sure we can afford to pay them either. It's a place to put them.
Well, the issue around Eskom, and, you know, let's revisit this. It's never been about, you know, transformation. What it has always been about has been theft. And it's been all about the corrupt contracts that have basically left Eskom in a situation where they make a product and they have to sell the product at a lower rate than it actually costs them to produce the product. And again, that's because we have this absurd situation where we have a national energy regulator that sets the price for your product. And it's exactly what went wrong in every communist country around the world that try to actually do price fixing.
Yeah.
And what happens when you have price fixing? You can't actually afford to produce the goods at that price, and it creates scarcity. And in our case, scarcity manifests itself in the form of load shedding. And my point around Eskom from the get-go has been any competent accountant who sits down and looks at Eskom and looks at its income statement and looks at its balance sheet is going to be immediately able to tell you how to fix Eskom. And, you know, as a very good example, I take Kaya Setole, who comes onto this show quite frequently. Mm-hmm. I promise you, you could get Kaya Setole to be chief executive of Eskom, and he would be able to fix it within a question of months because he is a highly competent chartered accountant, and he'll be able to tell you immediately, here's the harsh decisions that we need to make.
But the problem is that Eskom is politicized. Yeah, but this is what I was about to get to. So let's imagine you put someone like Kaya Setole in, and I agree with you, highly competent person who would be able to make the right decisions, or certainly analyze the situation and figure out what's going on. But then he would be prevented from making those decisions.
Exactly the point.
And the CEO of Eskom is a lame duck no matter who. And now this guy who we've got, ex of Nampak, and really they haven't performed very well. So he's not a stellar CEO by any
stretch
of the imagination.
Again,
it's moot because the government will ruin it.
Let's take a look at Durata, because, you know, I put that out there just to be deliberately provocative because
it is
one of the things that we should be focusing on. But at the same time, if someone were to turn around and say, well, take a look at Nampak's share price and see how it's actually performed. Well, Nampak is in the packaging business. And packaging generally tracks the overall state of the economy. So if you take a look at Nampak's share price and a chart, and if you take a look at the overall decline in terms of our economic output, there's a direct correlation that goes in place. My point is that the debate that we should be having around this should be focusing around trying to understand those particular things so that we don't do a superficial judgment that says, listen, Nampak has actually performed badly. Again, if you drill down into Nampak's figures, it has not performed badly. He's taken corrective measures, and even though the share price has declined, in terms of profitability and in terms of operating efficiencies, it's continued to actually hold its own. And, you know, would I consider the guy to be a good CEO based on the performance of that company? I would say absolutely yes.
All right. Can we talk about impeachment and Trump for a second? I know you're always keen to look overseas.
I thought we wanted to talk about the Democratic debate that happened last night.
Oh, well, let's talk about it. I wasn't even paying attention to it because I know I lost interest during the last debate when there was a lot of grandstanding and, you know, there was virtue signaling from just about every one of the candidates. And poor old Joe Biden is looking increasingly doddery. Did he perform himself? Did he acquit himself well last night?
No, I hate to say that. I had a very similar experience to the Dem debate as I did to John Stiernhazen.
Oh,
yes. And look, essentially, Bernie Sanders has declared that he is the son of immigrants, and so there was a collective shedding of tears from everyone who is against building the wall. And
oh, is that all it was? A pity party?
Yes, and all of the candidates are getting lambasted for not having spoken out on the question of trans rights, and there you go.
That's what it was.
That's what it was.
So wedge issues and nothing new.
So let's talk about impeachment. Yes, you know, the hearings have been proceeding apace. And it is such a farce. This impeachment process is never going to get past the Senate. Never.
Yeah, but a lot of people are saying it's absolutely essential to the good of the state. And if we don't follow this through and find out whether there was any wrongdoing, has there been any evidence given during the impeachment trial, the impeachment hearings so far in Congress, that would indicate that there is information that hadn't already been released publicly, either by the White House or by the Democratic Party? And you say it's farcical, but this Adam Schiff seems convinced he's doing something extremely virtuous here. And the Republican leader, in this case, Nunes,
yes,
has been at pains to point out how the media have played their role in making a mountain out of a molehill here. What are your immediate takeaways from that?
I tend to agree with Nunes' take on this. That look, the partisan nature of the U.S. media is absolutely clear. Does Trump have appallingly bad judgment in terms of understanding the rules of engagement? What we need to understand in terms of Trump is that he's uncouth.
To say the least.
Yes, but he's never understood the rules of engagement. He never went to the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy at my alma mater, which, you know, would have taught him the niceties of how one is meant to engage on the international stage. He just doesn't, you know, recognize the fact that you don't let things slip that will suddenly cause fluctuations in the currency, for example, or to cause the stock market to suddenly plummet. I mean, basically, every time he says trade talks are going badly, the stock market plunges. Trade talks are going well, the stock market goes up. And but at some point, that's actually refreshing, because
refreshing.
Yes, because he doesn't understand the rules. And I think it's good that you have someone who is actually sitting in this extremely powerful position, who's never actually gone through those processes. This is the Gordian knot, essentially.
Right.
You know, you've basically taken that sword and you've sliced it open. And now the world has to actually sit back and reevaluate the entire concept of how one actually runs democracies. Because this is democracy in action. This guy is the elected president.
It's just it's not the democracy in action that a lot of people wanted to see.
Yes.
It's an uncomfortable realization that we can't go back to the polite,
yes,
genteel ways of international diplomacy in the past.
Exactly. It's like the people, you know, who would shake their heads disapprovingly when they saw that I was strolling into the Rand Club as a member.
Yeah, it's exactly those people. Do you think that it's time they just caught a wake up? I mean, can we put this genie back in the bottle? Because Boris has got the same situation going on in England.
I don't think we can put this genie back in the bottle, but I think that what is really likely to happen is that it will lead to an overall decline in the ability of democratically elected leaders to do what they want to. The U.S., whatever you may say, still has checks and balances, and those checks and balances generally work quite well.
But so, is that a bad thing?
No, it's not a bad thing at all. You know, okay. So what I'm saying is that Trump's ability to actually do things that are totally outrageous are still somewhat limited. You know, so every time he wants to build the wall, for example, he gets hauled off to court, and there's a drawn-out process, but effectively that's a curb on the excesses of power. Mm-hmm. Every time he wants to say, get Muslims out of America, again, he gets hauled out to court, and generally he gets pulled in line. And
Are you saying that this is actually democracy working well, not just working?
This is democracy working well, yes. Huh. And I think democracy actually works better in the U.S. than it does in most parts of the world.
All right, but then why the hysteria that we see from the Democrats? Why are they so upset if everything is going swimmingly?
I think it's because they don't have an alternative. And if you go back to the last elections, they had put all of their eggs into one basket, and which was Hillary. And they haven't actually recovered from that, because what is the comeback? Who is the candidate that they're actually now going to rally around? And
they're looking at a bleak political future for themselves.
Until such time as Michelle Obama decides to run for president, yes.
You think that'll happen?
Oh, I don't know. I think if the timing is right, there's a very strong possibility.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, that would be an interesting thing to see happen. By the way, we've been trying to get Yan Yan back, but we've got some communication difficulties with him at the moment. I was going to ask him about his book in particular, his thoughts on why people keep voting for the ANC and what the future of white people is in South Africa, if any. Do you have any comments on why people vote ANC? Because this is also something that I call the soft bigotry of low expectations, where people assume a different set of values, a different set of ideals for poor people in a very patronizing way. And they assume a completely different set of values for people who are educated and rich like them. It never goes the other way around, funnily enough. You don't ever hear people who are poor and uneducated saying, you know, the problem with the rich people is they think X, Y, and Z.
Well, fewer people are voting for the ANC now than at any other time in history. But fewer people are voting than at any other time in history. So if you look at the trajectory, the ANC has actually gone back in terms of the sheer number of people who turn out of the polls. So, you know, the short answer is that unless you've actually got someone who's able to pop up with something that is actually going to provide an alternative, then we're pretty much going to have the same situation. If you think back to the conversation we had last week, Gareth, where we were talking about Musi Maimane potentially forming a new party. And again, contrary to everyone else's belief, I actually think that there's a space for Musi Maimane to have his party. If you look at what's happened in the by-elections over the past couple of weeks, where the DA took a bit of a pounding, and lost a couple of seats. But again, if you crunch the numbers, the reason why the DA took a pounding and lost those seats is because the vote got split.
Yeah.
And Good ended up effectively handing those seats to the ANC just simply by contesting the elections.
Okay, so the role of white people and Indian people and colored people in South Africa and in Africa, where we constantly hear from people like the EFF, who are not great arbiters of any real consequence, but let's just for a moment give them all the attention that they desire so much. Is there a role for these minority ethnic groups in a country which seemingly still carries favor with people of the attitude and the ideology that race politics is important? You said just now in the DA that one of the problems that you have with Steenhuisen's comments about Eskom, for example, is that he's pandering to that very crowd. Are there enough people who don't care about that stuff? Because if we look at stuff like the Institute of Race Relations and we see what people really are interested in, it isn't race and land. These are just the most incendiary discussions that happen. But the most important discussions to people are around employment, safety and security, access to education, access to resources.
Gareth, you're being too logical.
Oh. This is why I bring it up, because who's right and who's wrong here, and where do the majority of South Africans stand?
Well, the majority of South Africans actually say, you know, screw this entire obsession with politics. We're actually just going to get on with our lives.
Yeah.
And the net result of that is the number of people who actually pitch up at the polls. But I think, you know, by and large, what we try and do as South Africans across the board, and I'd like to think that this is actually the majority of black people as well, actually just get on with our lives.
Mm.
And, you know, we recognize that we've got incompetent people who are actually controlling the supposedly capable state. And, you know, we have to make other plans. So, you know, we put in place generators and gas stoves.
So look to yourself.
Yes, look to yourself.
Canton, your friend Pumi Mashiho,
yes,
was on the show on Tuesday, and she indicated that it's time that she wants to have a fight with you. So I think we must arrange that, at least an argument, a civil argument. Arrange that as some kind of a Christmas special for the Burning Platform. Would you be up for it?
Sure.
you know,
as long as it's a Thursday.
A Christmas, yeah, but a Christmas special in our language means an argument. And I think for most families it does.
Yes.
Okay, what we haven't referred to for a long time is the situation going on with the trade war between America and China. It's obviously simmered down a little bit. Markets in America are reaching ever higher and higher. It seems that the dividends of deregulation, tax breaks, and so on are starting to bear fruit for the American economy? And is it likely that any of this will play a part in the upcoming election 2020? Or do you think people are going to be dissuaded from that argument by wedge issues like you discussed at the Democratic debate last night, where trans rights and these kinds of things that affect a tiny, tiny proportion of the population will start to dominate the narrative?
I think that in the absence of something that's really going to negatively impact upon the lives of average Americans, generally elections will favor the incumbent.
In which case you're predicting a Trump victory.
In which case.
Unless there is some calamity.
Unless there's some calamity. Look, the thing in terms of the trade war, in spite of all of the predictions to the contrary, in fact, you've not seen the increase in consumer prices that people were actually predicting was going to come about as a result. And again, as we've said in the past, Trump has very successfully taken the revenue that he's earned from the tariffs and has plowed it back into subsidizing U.S. farmers who've been particularly hit by their inability to export soybeans to China.
How's this? And I don't know whether you saw any of this happening, because I do like having your opinion on these things when they break. With all of you guys together, do you have any comments on the bomb dropped by Adrian Basson this morning about Willem Breitenbach being a rapist starting his time as a teacher at Gray College? Do you know anything about that? That's news to me. It must have just happened. And please have Yan Yan on more. He's great. There's some comments. Very, very nice. It's interesting. Avbob have introduced a new green cremation. No flames, just water and heat. And you know, there was the story this week, which we discussed ad infinitum this morning. Maybe you've got something to say about it. About the family of a man who died in KZN, taking his body into the old mutual offices in Stanger and dropping it down there because they hadn't paid out some policy. They needed more documentation. This family were obviously frustrated. It's a horrible situation for anyone to find themselves in. And it's obviously really bad behavior on behalf of either the insurance company or the family or one of the parties. We don't know yet which is to blame. But this is the kind of thing that happens in South Africa almost uniquely. What do you make of that? And what do you think the best way is for us to deal with these things going forward, especially in the light of Avbob's new green cremation? Shouldn't we all just be buried under trees with the minimum of fuss?
Well, my theory in terms of green disposal of remains was actually a business plan that I put together many, many years ago. The entire idea is that you actually take the body onto a helicopter and fly it out to sea and feed it to the sharks.
It's a lot of helicopter trips.
Yeah, I know, but you know
that's not a good business plan at all. I'm not surprised it didn't work.
No, it's just that, you know, we didn't get the startup capital for it. But I think that, look, if we look into
a ship, just load the ship. I mean, a ship can take a whole lot more. And then you just open the bottom of the ship and let the sharks.
Well, you know, I think
it's your means of transportation I have a problem with.
No, let's put it this way. There is one person who took up the concept seriously.
Yes.
And that was Barack Obama.
How so?
Because that's how he disposed of bin Laden.
All right, but on this question of people who protest now to get attention on social media when they don't get what they want from either a funeral policy company or their electricity supplier.
I think it's great.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's actually forcing everyone to be on their toes. And it does force people to reevaluate their business strategies at a number of levels. I think that in the past you would have had, let's say in this particular case, that the paperwork for this funeral policy was actually not in order on the part of the people who had lost a loved one. And Old Mutual was actually waiting to get the paperwork. Now, actually, what they're forced to do is just simply to avoid the fallout. They just very quickly get the stuff paid and out of the way. But I think that that actually then forces them to up their game in terms of their rules, because in the absence of social media, they probably would have got away with not paying out legitimate claims as well, just simply because of the fact that there's not that that public scrutiny that's likely to cause them reputational risk.
I do want to quickly let everybody know what the story is, because we were talking about this just a second ago with not much clarity on what the actual story is. Media 24 and its holding company, NASPAS, have expressed shock at the allegations of sex crimes against former senior executive Willem Breitenbach, who served in various senior positions in both companies, follows revelations by Johannesburg copywriter and advertising executive Dion Wiggett that he was raped by Breitenbach when he was a minor in 1997. Since the publication of Wiggett's first revelations 2 weeks ago, numerous men who were allegedly attacked by him while he was a teacher at three high schools, including Grey College in Bloemfontein and in the employ of Media 24, have come forward. There are currently 16 men claiming to have been victims of Breitenbach. Esmarie Vedeman, the former CEO of Media 24, told News 24 she was not aware of any allegations, but it had been brought to her attention. No stone would have been left unturned to investigate them promptly and thoroughly. So that's the story people were referring to earlier on. And that's from Rian Grobler, a reporter at News 24. This has actually all come out in a series of podcasts from News 24. Interesting that that becomes one of the places now that breaking news is found as a podcast is released. But I don't know who this Willem Breitenbach is. I'm not sure what his background story is, but no doubt in the next few days we will see revelations of this. I wonder.
Is he still alive, this Breitenbach person?
Yes, seemingly.
Okay.
So I don't know what's going to happen here.
Well, but I mean, surely the thing is that charges then get filed. I mean, isn't that what's supposed to happen?
Well, usually, but I'm also interested in what the public response to this might be, especially because this is not really a person who's well known to everybody. He might be well known to a certain group of people, but not to everyone. Apparently, this is this is quite a story, though. There are lots of interesting things. Were there necessary checks done into his past employment as a teacher before he was appointed? The usual checks were done at the time, according to them. Was Media 24 ever made aware of any complaints of sexual harassment? We have no records of any complaints of this nature made against him. Why did he leave the employ of Media 24 in 2005 to go to India for NASPAS? Did his move to India have anything to do with allegations of wrongdoing? And they say his move was about the expansion of MIH's international print media operations there. We are not aware of any other reasons behind his secondment. What is the company's reaction to the revelation that he allegedly raped Wiggett as a schoolboy? We were shocked. So there are all these questions that are being answered now. I don't know whether this story is going to explode and there'll be more revelations, there'll be more people coming forward. But clearly there's an undercurrent of sexual predation. I wanted to ask you, Canton, since we've got a couple of minutes. Sia and Gugu and I read a story this morning about the Sex Offenders Register. And in South Africa, how there is a reluctance to publish that openly, generally. At the moment, you can find out if someone is a sex offender if, for example, you work with children or people who are mentally disabled and you are responsible for their protection. So before you hire someone, you're able to find out whether they're on the register or not. But everyone else is not allowed to just know that information. Obviously, this is to protect people, not because they're sex offenders, but because we live in a culture of some arbitrary violence and occasional kangaroo court justice, where some of these people may have certain horrible things done to them just because their names are known. Do you believe that we're at a point in South Africa where, you know, we still need to protect people, innocent or guilty, from the wrath of the public courts, the public court of, or the court of public opinion, or do you think that we're able to disclose this information for the protection people to take, you know, take care for, of their own, of their young, of themselves in the presence of sex predators?
Sure.
Such a complicated question.
This is a complicated question because I think one would have a different view on this if one was living in a society that actually had rule of law and that actually had, you know, the ability to follow up on basics of policing. We have this, the story, for example, that, you know, it was in court yesterday about the guy who, purportedly set, fire to his girlfriend. Oof. And a couple of things that, you know, happened out here. Firstly, there was the fact that, there was CCTV footage of the guy supposedly buying petrol at a petrol station.
Yeah.
And which would have been material evidence in terms of the fact that, you know, he buys the petrol and then goes and sets fire to his girlfriend. The police don't actually take the trouble to get the CCTV footage, even though it was available at the time. And then obviously because of the way in which the CCTV systems work, by the time they finally said, oh, we need this stuff, these, it's been taped over. So they don't, have access to the footage. Secondly, purportedly at the time that they arrested the guy, he had burns all over his body. Do they take pictures of the burns? Do they record it? Do they actually send it for examination so that they can have this as material evidence? No. So now, the guy pitches up in court and none of the evidence that would actually have convicted him if the evidence were to hand, is to be available. So the courts will now have to decide whether, testimony that the woman basically spoke to a couple of people before she died, she succumbed to her burns, and they want, they now need to make a decision in terms of whether the testimony that she gave will be admitted as evidence. And I'm using this as an example to say that, you know, just having something like a sex offenders registry in of itself is not going to give us any level of protection against these, you know, very
sex predators,
these very real predators that that are out among us. You know, some of them go on to found trade unions and then to hold SAA hostage.
Those people will remain quite clearly, obviously named in the public space, but others will not.
Yes,
and we don't know. I mean, maybe there's also reluctance for sex offenders registers to be published because there will be so many names on them.
Well, you'd actually first need to be caught and put onto the sex registers, sex offenders registry. And, you know, ask yourself, for example, how many of the, using the case of pop crew members, you know, the 3,000 convicted police officers who are actually serving as police officers in spite of having criminal convictions. So you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of a sex offenders registry?
Yeah. Well, we don't know the answer to that, but it's worthy of at least some discussion. Thanks for jumping around with me this morning on a number of different issues. And sorry we couldn't get Yan Yan back because there were still lots of things I wanted to ask him. Is he all right, Sia? Is it just a question of communication difficulty?
Yes, all good. Yeah, and Skype on our side.
Canton, always good to see you. Thank you very much for dropping by this morning and jaw-dropping by. I think Yan Yan is still traumatized by your comments about Steenhuisen's lack of intellectual capacity.
Oh, listen, you know, look, I'm sure that Steenhuisen means well, but
all right, yeah. Well, very good. Canton Pillay, back again for the Burning Platform next week, and thank you to you for joining us. We will see you then. It's all brought to you by Nando's, who are on top of all of this by helping you to sustain yourself with the best in peri peri hot chicken, the kind that you like when you're dealing with burning platforms like this. It is just before 8 o'clock, cliffcentral.com. Good morning.
Cliffcentral.com.